And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today we have Doug Salter, board member and volunteer with Attack Addiction. And Doug, welcome. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you today?
I am fine and happy to see you here. We are recording this show, of course, via Zoom. Let's get started with what is the organization? What is Attack Addiction?
Attack Addiction has basically transpired into so many more things than we ever thought it would. Our mission basically is to raise awareness about the disease of addiction and to also erase the stigma that's associated with it. Through educating communities, assisting families in their quest for information, and supporting those in recovery, Attack Addiction seeks to remove the stigma of addiction by effecting positive change in Delaware throughout the entire state.
Let's back it up then and talk a little bit about how did you get started? And you say that it's evolved.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is crazy when I sit there and think that back in September 8th, 2012 was probably one of the worst days that my wife and I ever had. It's the day that we took our son to his first treatment center. And we were both lost after dropping him off at the treatment center, and we're looking for a group to try to get involved with. Back in 2012, it seems like it's not that far from where we are right now, but things have just changed so much since 2012. And there really wasn't any type of groups out there, supportive groups that we knew about. We were really lost. I'm retired from the state police. My wife is a nurse. Both of us, with the amount of contacts that we had throughout the state, really didn't feel that we found the group we had until we found Attack Addiction. And the first meeting we went there, it was just an open group. It wasn't, this is what you did wrong, this is what you need to do. It was more of about a lot of families dealing with the same thing. The only difference is a lot of the families that were there had lost a loved one where ours was still alive. And that transpired into us really getting involved, both my wife and I, me joining the board, and then from there just really growing along with the organization itself.
In 2012, were we talking about the opioid addiction at that point, which is what now, when we say addiction, we automatically go there. But addictions have been with us forever.
They have. And we've got history in our family after. I mean, obviously, it's been close to 10 years that we've been dealing with this personally. And from doing a lot of research, doing a lot of background, working with people that are being impacted the same way that our family's been impacted, we have found that it is a disease. It is an addiction runs in our family. And unfortunately, out of the three kids, our three kids, one has the gene, and it has just really just been an issue for him to really get a grasp of his addiction. It's been an up and down battle for the last 10 years.
Again, I keep alluding to opioids, and now we think, and heroin and all. But it's also, it's alcohol too, is it?
It is. It's not just opiate. It's alcohol. It's any type of addiction. The group that we have set up, I mean, we are open-minded for the entire state. It initially started with a large amount of people from Newcastle County. We found the need that this isn't obviously just a Newcastle County issue. It's a statewide, it's a nationwide issue. So we expanded throughout the state in all three counties. And we feel that we're trying to grow a group of people from all different backgrounds so that we can better understand exactly how they have been impacted by this disease as well.
Well, disease does not know what it is, who it is it's attacking. So you're seeing families of all types, all economic backgrounds, all ethnicities and upbringing and all.
Without a doubt. Back in 2015, I was asked to do a presentation in front of a large amount of legislators throughout the state of Delaware. And the question again was, who is Attack Addiction? But the more I thought about it, I realized Attack Addiction is not about the accomplishments that we've done over the last 10 years. The real meaning of this group revolves around the people who are involved in it and carry out the mission. Those are the parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, siblings, friends that have lost someone to the disease of addiction, or even a family member, a friend in recovery. All these different types of people have joined together to make Attack Addiction what it is today.
Let's start then with the basic tenets of Attack Addiction. And you started off with education. When you go out, are you looking for the families? Are you talking to the person who is suffering from an addiction? Who do you want to educate?
It's actually, this program has gotten so large, more than any of us. I mean, at the present time, Attack Addiction has no employees. Everything that we do is done by volunteers, the board members, people that have volunteered and everything else. So we do this all on our own. There are no employees that we have doing it, you know, Monday through Friday, 40 hours a week. This is just a really large group of, as I said earlier, a lot of family members that have gotten involved with attack addiction, and for the cause of just trying to make it easier on someone else who's going through the same thing that we've gone through, but trying to be able to help them through that process. So they're not as lost as I said, my wife and I were back in 2012.
It's all volunteer. And I know that you have programming. You do direct services, right?
We definitely do, yes. The organization provides support for recovering addicts and their loved ones, advocates for policy changes throughout, you know, through the government, educates families about opiate addiction and treatment options. And we also work to prevent drug use, and we strive to end the stigma of the disease, as I've said several times. The most important thing we do is trying to reach out to people to let them know that there is a group out there that is willing to help them and to get them the help they needed once they are ready to get that help.
I know that you have housing, you have meetings for families and for people struggling with their addictions. But let's back it up for prevention. How do you prevent a disease? And let's talk a little bit about the other things that go hand in hand with addiction, and that's mental health issues.
It is. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people... the prevention is getting out there and getting the word out to people, starting at a young age, discussing issues with younger people in the school area. We're trying to get more involved with the schools. We're trying to get programs into the schools. We're trying to get our information out to the families, because what we found, especially during this COVID, and I just read a report last week, that the amount of younger kids now starting to drink and then going to drugs and then also, unfortunately, suicide has increased dramatically over the last 10 months because of, and they're basing it, again, there's still a lot of research out there right now, but a lot of it is based off of because of the COVID and the isolation feeling and the kids not being able to be around each other. When I say kids, we're talking, they have seen it at as early as 10, 11 years old, where these kids are starting to drink and then starting to go to additional things to make them just, I guess, forget about the pain or the loneliness that they have right now during this process.
We just talked to Chris Locke from Sean's House a week or so ago.
No Chris person, yeah.
And he talked about the ages of 14 to 24 just being, you know, a terrible time for a young person, because you're becoming an adult, you're facing all kinds of social pressure, educational pressures. When you talk to young people, are you trying to get them to recognize their behaviors might open the door for worse behaviors later on? How do you approach it?
It's really been hard for us as a group as well, because with the COVID going on, we can't have our regular monthly meetings that we used to have, where we'd have anywhere from 75 to 120 people show up, families, people in recovery, people looking for help. These used to be such incredible meetings because you really could get a feel for who the person is. Zoom is fine because it keeps you involved, but it also doesn't have the same impact as actually being there, sitting with someone who has been through it, who has lost a loved one, or who has a loved one in treatment, or a loved one that's presently in the thrust of addiction, and actually talking to them to see what are some of the things that they've done to try to help them through the process. This addiction, I mean, especially just personally through our family, this thing has impacted not only my son, but has impacted our entire family, from my 85-year-old mom to, you know, my nephews and nieces, or I'm sorry, his nephews and nieces, but my grandkids, because they miss him when he's not around, when he's not there to be involved with family events. They know something's going on, and it impacts them, and it impacts the whole family.
You mentioned that back in 2012, you were taking your son to his first treatment, and this is an ongoing process. I mean, there is no cure for addiction. There's just treatment and moving on and living with it.
Well, unfortunately, that's how naive I think my wife and I were. And again, we both seen it firsthand because of our professions. But when you're dealing with it personally, and it's your own child, we both thought that at that point he would go to treatment. He was 18 years old. He was going to come out and everything was going to be fine. Little did we know that, as you just said, this is a disease. It's an addiction. And unfortunately, it's something he's going to have to deal with for the rest of his life.
How do you talk to families then? How do you, first, again, going back to the idea of stigma, was it something that you did? Was it something that you could have prevented? Was it something you failed to say? Then living with a family member that's going through this and will always be going through this.
There is a ton of guilt as a parent when something like this happens. And I think there was more on my plate just because of my background, because what I used to do as a profession and my wife is a nurse, both of us feeling like we had missed something, that we should have caught something a lot earlier, that we should have seen some of the signs ahead of time. And I think this is what families really need to realize is these addicts are really good at what they do. And I say that because they really are able to keep it from the families, and you don't even notice when things are going bad until it gets to a point where you really know you need to get help, you know, for the person who's in, you know, in the addiction. So it is, it's really hard. There's a lot of guilt on the family. There's a lot of guilt on us as parents. But I think one of the things that I stress to the family members now is all you can do is look forward and try to get your loved one the help that they need. And you need to get yourself help as well, because it's not just for the person that it has the addiction. Like I said earlier, the whole family is impacted by it. And as a family, you really need to make sure you're taking care of yourself as well. This breaks you down. There's been many days when my wife and I have just felt like we were out of answers. We didn't know where to go. We didn't know what to do. And there are still, I'm not going to lie, there's still some days now, 10 years later, that I still feel the same way. And it's unfortunate, but as I have realized, as I have found out, the addiction will be for a lifetime. So it's us trying to figure the addiction out, us trying to figure out our son, and our son realizing that we're there to help him.
The connection between mental health and addiction is obviously there. And addiction is often an attempt, and you alluded to it as well, stopping the pain. It's self-medicating. Were there signs, or do you talk about signs when you talk to schools or when you talk to parent groups? Do you say, here's what you should be looking for? Because they're going to be hiding it from you, obviously. And what parent is going to be thinking in these terms until, like you, it's there?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. My son had a normal high school situation. He was a big athlete. It ended up being an injury in high school that he really worked really hard to rehab himself and everything else. And eventually got hurt again when he got back into play. And I think a lot of that had a lot to do with his psychological and his head that, you know, he wasn't going to be able to play at the level he used to be able to play at. I'm not making excuses. I would never do that. He's never said this. In my mind, I think I'm just looking for a reason as to why this would have started this way. I mean, he's been very open and honest with us. He started drinking as early as seventh grade that I didn't even have a clue. With his friends, all the regular kids. I mean, his group of friends we knew all the families. They were all just like us. There were no issues, that way, no criminal activity during, that stage. And it just, it really, to be able to tell a family, these are the exact signs you have to look for, I wouldn't be able to do, because each one of them is different. But there are certain signs that people need to be aware of, especially if they start seeing their loved ones withdraw from family events or friends that they used to hang out with. If they start, these are just some small ones. If you feel like you start seeing things missing, at times we started finding money missing. And that's how I realized that there was an issue, is because one day I got home and he left everything on our bed, but had wiped out the jewelry and everything else. So unfortunately, there are situations like that where you start realizing it's a bigger problem than we ever thought.
In the seventh grade, there probably were no overt signs for you to catch. He and his friends were obviously very good at concealing what they were up to. So at that point, the only thing that might have clued you in was had you specifically straightforward asked him. And would any parent think to ask a kid at that age, what are you involved in? Or have you been approached, or have you thought about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not one of those things where we always had an open relationship with him. So we've always had that talk with him about drugs and alcohol. Obviously, back in that time period when he was in eighth grade, which would have been back in the 2008, 2009, they had the DARE program and they had that educational thing at a school where he went. So it's not that they hadn't been talking about it. I just don't think any of them, at least in his group, ever realized that the things that they were getting involved in could potentially cause this many issues. Out of the group that he had a group of friends that, I mean, it was a large group. It was about 10, 11 that really hung out all the time. Out of that group, three of them ended up having addiction problems. And all three of them have family histories with addiction. So it really, there's still so much research that's going on with this disease and everything else. And I am not an expert on it. I'm just a dad who is trying to help other parents just really realize that there's other people out there going through the same type of things, and they need to reach out and get themselves help. And if there's one thing that I can just tell a parent that may relieve some of their pain, that's what our group's about.
If you're just joining us, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and today we're talking to Doug Salter. He's a board member and volunteer with Attack Addiction, and you can find them at attackaddiction.org. When you go there, you'll find out the ways to contact them. You'll find out about the programming that they offer, which are meetings and educational opportunities, and also they have housing. And so again, attackaddiction.org for anything we're talking about. So let's get back, though, and talk about the proactive things that you are doing, the meetings and the housing, which is remarkable. And then let's get into the wish list and getting more into high schools or helping younger people suffering from addiction issues.
Yeah, one of the things that we're really proud of is that we now have 68 total beds for men and women throughout the state of Delaware. We have 7 total homes. It's for people in early recovery. We have a program that we have with, it's an environment for men and women that they can work on their recovery. Our case management services are provided to the residents through a collaborative partnership with Community Collaboration of Delaware to assist them with their continued treatment and recovery, obtaining employment, and budgeting. So they understand a lot of people with this disease, they'll get money in their pocket and it'll be gone within 2 days, 3 days. They just don't have that budgeting experience. So one of the things we're really trying to stress to them is to teach them how to budget, how to put money aside, how to save their money. The residents who come through our housing, they make a personal commitment to obtain a sponsor, actively work the 12 steps, and regularly attend AA or NA meetings. It's important for us to keep them involved in the community of other people that are dealing with this issue so they can talk about it with others.
And they can come and go as they please, but no guests, no visitors, no family. Once they get a job, they start paying you rent.
It is. We have it set up where we have 3 houses currently right now, 2 for the women, 1 for the men, where for the first 30 days, 35 days, they don't have to pay a dime. We provide them with a clean house, a safe house, case management, and as already discussed, we get them into the program where they feel comfortable about themselves. And there are restrictions. There are rules. They have to be in by a certain time. They are tested. They have to be working the program. And once they get to a point where they feel comfortable with the program and are able to go out and get a job, there's houses that they can then move into that Attack Addiction runs, where they can then live there while they're working, paying a small fee, so they can get back on their feet with the intention of hopefully getting them out where they can be on their own. But they also always know that we're there for them, the group's there for them to be able to be part of it.
While they're participating or while they're part of your programming, they're in the 12 steps, and that is the AA, right? But yet you have meetings of your own. Who are you talking to? Are they peer groups, and are they for the people under addiction, or are you talking to the families as well?
You know, it's awesome. As I said earlier, before the COVID, when we had our meetings, which we hold down at Caravelle Academy, it's usually the second Tuesday of every month. We had large groups from anywhere from 75 to 100 people. And the way we did it is the first half hour, we'd sit there and just go over any items that are on the agenda, letting people know things that are going on. But then we break it down. So we have support groups where you could go in if you're in recovery or in the active addiction state. You can go into a meeting with people that are dealing with the same thing that you are. But then we also have another group broken down where it's for the family members, so the family members could talk. And then the rest of the people, what we do is we break into groups and we start working on our different initiatives, whether it be the 5K, whether it be the housing, or we're trying to really get a high school program started for people in addiction, because it's not as easy for someone who is in their early stages of high school and have gone to recovery or gone to treatment and then come back to get into that regular routine of high school. So what we're trying to do is, and it's, there are some programs throughout the nation that are out there now. We're trying to get one here in the state of Delaware where we have a program where it can be a high school program for those people to go to school and get their education while they're going through the school with other people that are dealing with the addiction.
We all know that that addiction affects the entire family. We've already spoken about that. But then when we look, though, to the person who's going through addiction, how important is the family to recovery?
It's incredible. I'll be honest with you. And it's, every family's not the same. But if a person has a family member or several family members that are there to support them, it only makes their time dealing with the addiction easier because they know they have the support of the family. And there are families that just don't know what else to do. And I can't say what's the right one, the tough love, or I know it, at some point throughout the process, I was probably the biggest enabler around, and that didn't do any good. All it did was cause more issues. So I've had a lot to learn about how I interact with him and how I deal with him during certain situations. And I'm not saying I'm any better than I was back in 2012, but I am working on it. And that's where I really think this impacts the family as much as the person actually in the addiction.
Part of the problems with families is, of course, the stigma that they experience. So getting this discussion out there, getting more support, getting more organizations behind the effort has to be a big part of what you're doing, your advocacy work. You want to talk a little bit about what you're trying to get accomplished there. Are you talking to our officials, our legislature, our state, et cetera?
Well, I'll be honest with you. It's been incredible what we've been able to sit down and really work with the administration of the state of Delaware, as long with the local governments. We have been actively having meetings with representatives from DSAM for the last 3 years on a monthly basis, where we talk about the things that we're seeing at Attack Addiction. They're telling us some of the things that they're seeing coming through DSAM, some of the issues that they're having, some of the recovery fields that they have. So it's, the partnerships are incredible. And even though we're a nonprofit and, again, we have no employees, it's all the volunteers taking time to meet with the people that can actually make a difference. And by doing this, some of the accomplishments that we've had that I'd like to talk about right now is one of the first ones that we were able to do was to get the Good Samaritan Law passed. And this was back in 2013. And the law is formerly known as the Kristen L. Jackson and John M. Perkins Law. The law grants people who report overdoses from drugs or alcohol immunity from prosecution from certain drug crimes and from offenses related to underage drinking, even if the caller was involved in those types of activities. And as I said, even though the law has been on the books since 2013, we need to continually be more aware around this life-saving law, because people need to know if they're with someone who is having an overdose, and a lot of times they'll get scared and they'll be afraid that they were doing something with that person and they don't report it. We want them to know that they need to report it. And with this law, it protects them so they don't get in any type of trouble, you know, for reporting it. The other big one that we've really have been able to, and we're really proud of, is getting Narcan into the hands of the first responders, school nurses, certified individuals, and family members of addicts, so that we can prevent overdose deaths by dispensing this life-saving drug. We've been really fortunate to the point where Dave Humes, who was also a board member with Attack Addiction, is usually doing at least 3 to 4 training sessions of Narcan every month, just to be able to get it into as many people's hands as possible. And that's our goal, so that they know what's going on, that they know how to use it, and that if something happens or a situation occurs, that they're ready to be able to perform a life-saving by using the Narcan.
What about the high school?
I'd love to say that we're really close with this high school. It's not as easy as, it's a great idea that we have. It's something that Don Keister, who is one of the founders of Attack Addiction, has really been working hard on. And it's something that I really think that if we continue to try to make the inroads that we are, we're really going to have a good opportunity to be able to do it. It may only serve 6 to 10, 15 people, but those 6 to 10, 15 people are going to be able to get an education where they wouldn't be able to do it in any other circumstance or environment.
Let's get started then. how we can help you. And obviously, if you have no staff and you're all volunteers, you're looking for volunteers. Who do you want to pick up the phone or go to your website, attackaddiction.org, and volunteer? And then how do we support you? Because with COVID, obviously, big fundraisers have been halted. And I know that you're in the middle of one right now that would have been your annual run. So talk a little bit about how we can support Attack Addiction.
Yeah. The 5K race is just so much more than a race. It's a movement. It's comprised primarily of participants who have been personally impacted by the disease of addiction by either overcoming an addiction, having lost a loved one to the addiction, and or currently living with an addicted loved one. It has been described as a spiritual experience. Last year, over 4,500 people participated in this one-day event. And fortunately for us, it was 2 weeks before COVID really had an outbreak and they started shutting things down. So we were really fortunate to be able to host the event last year. If you haven't been to this event, it is an incredible event. It's held usually on the first Saturday of March every year. It's cold. It's down in historical Newcastle. We walk through it and it's just incredible to see the different teams that people are there supporting family members and people in recovery. They'll have t-shirts, they'll have sweatshirts, they'll have signs, banners. It's, as I said, it's more than a 5K. It is just a really incredible movement when last year was just incredible. Unfortunately, because of COVID, the 8th annual Attack Addiction Erasing the Stigma 5K has to go virtual this year. We're not all going to be able to be together. So we're doing a little differently than we have in the past. And while we're upset that we can't gather together in March for such an amazing cause, we know that this year will be just as amazing as we see everyone post their 5K on our social media page.
So we form our teams like we would have any other year. We register and then we just we self-report what we're doing, and that's how we participate this year. And it's going on now through March the 6th. That'd be the first Saturday in March this year.
It is. And it's not going to be the same, but teams have already gotten together and done some of their things on the weekends and sent in videos and everything else. So although we can't be together, we're trying to make it where people still know that this is an activity, this is an event that they can participate in, they can show their support for their loved ones, and they can sit there and make a difference.
What about volunteers?
Volunteers are the only way that we're able to make any of this happen. I mean, it's incredible. With the 5K last year, as I said, we had 4,500 people. We had over 210 volunteers, which it sounds like so much, but the infrastructure of the 5K having that many people, it's without them, it would never have worked. Now, unfortunately, again, and I keep bringing up COVID, we haven't been able to have the events that we have had in the past, but we are really looking, once we are past this and we get to a point where we're able to loosen up some of the restrictions because of COVID, our volunteers are involved in our housing. We're looking for people to pick up furniture when people want to donate couches, chairs, those type of things. We're looking for people who have a background in budgeting so we can have individual meetings with the different houses. So it's not just relying on one person to go and try to do it statewide. Because as you well know, as a volunteer, if it gets too much, you get burnt out. So we're trying to spread it out where we get a lot of people involved who have a lot of different backgrounds to be able to help these people in any way possible to make it easier on them to work on their recovery so that they can get themselves back out into the community.
Tell us, what would you like us to take away from today?
One of the things I'd like to say is, although the state of Delaware has been incredible and the government, from the legislators to the governor, have all been very supportive of this, the government can't do this alone. Attack Addiction can't do this alone. We cannot allow the state to own this all by itself. With the state's budget resources getting tighter and tighter every year, nonprofits such as Attack Addiction have to work together with other nonprofits to provide services in ways that they have not been able to be utilized in the past. My challenge to the people and the corporations in the state of Delaware is to get active and work with the state and Attack Addiction and the various nonprofits to continue to drive meaningful change on the war on drugs in the state of Delaware.
Well, I am afraid that we are out of time. And Doug Salter, if you would like to come back, you are more than welcome to come back again.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate it.
Doug Salter is a board member and volunteer with Attack Addiction. And you can find them, again, all the information that we talked about today, attackaddiction.org. Doug, thanks for being on. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.